Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grab some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. I'm joined by two of our correspondents who've been with us for 12 years since this broadcast started. Suckers for punishment. Punishment, I say. Adam Devlin is in Melbourne and Rachel Brunston is in Canberra. Welcome to our broadcast.
Two of you.
Thanks. Hello,
been together for such a long time.
That's right. And to celebrate that, we're going to talk about nothing.
I love talking about nothing. It's my favourite thing.
It's the one thing I know something about. Vinyl certainly took a hit for a couple of years, but it's rebounded back now and it's selling as much. It's selling as much now vinyl as they ever did.
Mm. It's a warmer sound, isn't it?
Mm, absolutely. And it's also, again, it's like that I said about the cinema. We're a social thing, and vinyl, it's that tactic. You can hold the sleeve and you can read the who wrote the song and you can read who's performing on it and you can read the lyrics. And
our correspondent in Dublin, Declan Hughes, talks about the 1980s.
I fled Ireland like thousands of people back in the 1980s. Actually, strangely enough, I didn't go because I didn't have a job. I left a radio job. I just wanted to get away. I went to the UK and subsequently, obviously, Australia. In the early 80s, what did you want to do with your life professionally?
Well, I went to UCD and I did a degree, not with a view to getting a job, just with giving a view to, I got into UCD, I got into an arts program, I picked two subjects I figured I could stand reading about for 4 years, and true to this day, I can still stand reading about them, so I chose wisely, namely history and political science. As it turns out, they were helpful in me ending up with a degree in public service. A job in public service, not by choice. There was nothing else available. I did try to get into radio, and I did a broadcasting course run by the radio stations you spent many happy years working for. And I was due to start working on a small-scale local pirate in Blanchardstown in 1983, the week after I graduated university. I don't know if I shared the story with you before, Henry. But anyway, I was due to do a program as a disc jockey, don't you know, on Blanchardstown Community Radio on, I think it was the third Monday in October. Yeah. So I went out in my on the bus. Blanchardstown was in the middle of nowhere for our listeners who might know Dublin. It was a small, sleepy country village at the time. It's since become a very urbanized suburb. So you had to take a bus and it would take like forever to get from the city centre. So I left home, to head for my new work, as I thought, at about 7:30 in the morning to be out there in time. Got into the city centre, got on the 39, I think it was. Mm. And I arrived about 45 minutes before I was due to go on the air. I arrived in the station to be met by the station attendant who told me they'd been raided the night before and the transmitter was gone.
And that's a common story from the 1980s.
And my broadcasting career was over more or less before it had begun for a while.
With 21 correspondents in 7 countries from around the world, this is Bondi Tunes International.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. In our series on depression, I've been following the lives of people with various forms of depression. We can't put depression in a media box and just call it something. It's something different to each person who has some form of it. Here on Bondi Tunes, we have interviewed many people with some form of depression, simply because someone has to. Mainstream media give you a snapshot of what it's like to feel you're living in hell. We know all about this. 4 of our global correspondents have some form of depression, including me. It doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. We want to take the stigma, the taboo, out of this. You might be surprised to hear this, but people with depression are running state governments, and indeed governments of the world. Depression does not dictate to any class or race. It's everywhere. We talk about pandemic these days with COVID. Well, depression is also a kind of pandemic. But not enough people are talking about that. Well, we'll always take the taboo out of depression. That's our job. In this interview, I'll chat with 50-year-old Nicola Braid, who lives in Liverpool in England.
Of hindsight, of this behaviour, for want of a better word, I just thought, coming up to my 40th birthday, I thought, I can't do the next 25 years like I've done the last 25 years. It's exhausting. Yes. And I've had a good life, Henry. Do you know what I mean? There's been no trauma or drama. There's nothing to indicate any triggers that would create depression. It's just always been there. And it was really from that point, and again, coming up to my 40th birthday, I thought, right, I've got to get this looked into, and I've got to do whatever I need to do to get to the bottom of it.
On air and online at bondi-tunes.com. This is Bondi Tunes Australia, mate.
Bondi Tunes International. Carol Cotter is our multilingual language educator, and she is in southern Spain. Adam Devlin is our political correspondent, and he is here in Australia, Melbourne to be precise. Not sure how much they have in common, but one thing I can be sure of is that neither of them eat meat. Carol is a vegan, Adam is a vegetarian. We're going to talk about food, folks. I have them both on the line. Welcome to Bondi Tunes International, guys.
Welcome.
Hi, Henry.
Firstly, if I can go to you, Carol, in Spain, was it for ethical reasons that you stopped eating not only meat, but became a vegan?
Yes, it was. Well, vegan was a mixture of all the reasons, really. But when I first originally became a vegetarian, it was only for ethical reasons, because I was only 10, so I really didn't know a lot about nutrition or any problems to do with eating meat. So vegetarianism was ethical, and then I became a vegan when I was 22, and mostly for ethical reasons, but also for health reasons and every reason possible, yeah. Really.
Adam, your reason for, Adam and I have known each other for, I'm not going to tell you, too long, 25 years.
We met in the Battle of Waterloo. Mm.
We did. It's a long time ago, and we used to go out at lunchtime. We both worked in the same company, and we'd go out and get chicken, greasy chicken and chips and stuff like that. Adam, what changed your mind about this?
Well, Henry, it's something that had always weighed on my mind.
From a young age?
From a young boy, yeah. I grew up in the country, as regular listeners will know, and my family, I come from a truck-driving family, a family full of big, hairy, testosterone-driven truck drivers, and that's just the women. And meat was, our staple. Most families on a Sunday lunch would have, a roast and a pile of veggies. We'd have a roast of one sort of meat and all the veggies. We'd have like roast beef, roast chicken and roast lamb and some potatoes.
And here in Australia, Adam, I noticed when I first came here in 89 is that people would actually, especially in country areas like where you came from, they'd actually have lamb chops for breakfast.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it wasn't uncommon in our house when I was a young boy, when my father was working, that he would have steak for breakfast. Mm. That meat was an integral part of our, in fact, it wasn't just an integral part, it was in every meal we had. But I was never a comfortable meat eater. I never really enjoyed eating it. And I did try as a teenager to go vegetarian, but I was still living at home with my parents, and that was a wasted effort. So I went back to eating meat. But about 10 years ago, I read a book called The Ethics of What We Eat by Peter Singer and Jim Mason. Mm-hmm. And the book is not about turning people into vegetarians or into vegans. It's just basically saying, if you're going to, we should, as ethical beings, understand where the food that is on our plate came from and how it got to be on our plate. Mm. And upon reading the book, I just dawned on me that when I did eat meat, I was very picky about what sort of meat I would eat. I never liked any sort of meat on a bone. I didn't like it as a big chunk of meat. I'd much preferred it to be minced or cubed in a wet dish or something like that so that it didn't look like an animal. Mm. And I also realized that there was absolutely no possible way that I could kill an animal and slaughter and butcher an animal myself to eat it. Mm. And so two things dawned on me. One was, what right do I have to have somebody else kill an animal and butcher it so that I could eat it? And also, what ethical right have I got to then say to that dead animal, well, I'm only going to eat this little piece of you and I don't really care what happens to the rest of you?
Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grab some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp.
Ladies and gentlemen, to whom it concerns, it's The Late Late Show. And here is your host, Gay Byrne.
Thank you.
This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting from Sydney, Australia. Of course, around the world. And around the world, I go to our North America political correspondent, Ronan Seagrave, who is in Canada, in Winnipeg. Welcome to our broadcast.
Good evening, Henry.
It's quite a week that was, as our jingle says, with Enda at the beginning of this show. Gay Byrne basically was RTE. He was RTE, the national broadcaster in Ireland. He was a broadcaster for some six decades on Irish radio, then Irish television, and he actually went to Granada TV in the UK at one stage. But let's talk about Gay's involvement with Irish politics, the social life of Ireland at the time. This show started on the 5th of July 1962. It was called The Late Late Show. 3 days after I was born, Ronan, I think I just got into the world three days in time to watch Gaybo. Tell us about Gay Byrne and his effect on the Irish scene, because let's face it, the Catholic Church ran Catholic Ireland at the time.
It did. I mean, Gay Byrne he was without question, Henry, one of the most significant people in Ireland over the past, as you say, 50, 60 years. I mean, we both grew up with Gay Byrne. He was everywhere. He had his daily radio show on RT Radio 1. He was probably the first person on Irish radio, Henry, to have the phone in, people actually ringing him up and talking about issues of the day. I mean, he was doing that in late 60s, early 70s. Mm. And then, of course, The Late Late Show, as you say, which started in 1962 and which he presented continuously for 37 years.
Yeah, but it's important to note that Gay Byrne, let's just go back a bit. In the late 50s, he had been working on the national broadcaster RTE Radio 1, which was the only broadcaster in Ireland. He went for a fleeting visit to the UK and Granada TV, and that was 1963. But in 1962, he is given 12 shows, apparently, of The Late Late Show on RTE. And look at all these years later.
Yeah, quite extraordinary. No one could have thought back then that Gay Byrne would have been presenting that show, as I say, for 37 years. I mean, he did, as you say, spend a bit of time sort of going back and forth to England. I mean, famously on Granada TV, he interviewed the Beatles.
Yes.
In a memorable clip. He didn't really like England, Henry. I mean, he didn't like London at all. And he made a decision sort of in the early 60s to really just focus his career in Ireland and living in Dublin. Mm. And he became really the face and voice of RTE, as I say, with the daily radio show and The Late Late Show, which he also produced. I mean, he was a man, Henry, with an enormous appetite for work.
Yeah, and he did. He did produce. We've got a bit of a bad line here, Ronan, but he did produce it. And just to explain, producing means timing the ad breaks. And I think RTE had ad breaks at the time, still do. And if you're a producer, you've got to time everything. And he's doing that and multitasking. And I just want to briefly mention something very funny, because Gay Byrne never used an auto cue. Never. He hated them. And in the 90s, and sorry, I think we need to go further into the early 2000s, when a man called Ryan Tubridy, I never pronounce his name properly, who continues to do The Late Late Show, one of the longest running entertainment TV shows on the planet. Anyway, he's sitting there being interviewed by Ryan, and he goes up to the camera and covers the auto cue and says, "Now try and see, how you present this show."
Yeah, you know, it is interesting, Ronan, that there was really very little organisation to this show. You know, use the term freewheeling. It really was, wasn't it?
It was freewheeling. I mean, the show was a mix of, you know, often celebrity interviews, you know, big name movie stars, people like Charlton Heston appeared on the show. Gay was terrific, Henry, with guests I would describe as sort of raconteurs, you know, Peter Ustinov, Spike Milligan, Billy Connolly. They were kind of frequent guests on the show, and Gay would just let them tell sort of very, very funny stories. But then it also had sort of what I would describe as sort of groundbreaking sort of social debates.
Yes.
Which are really the first time, Henry, on Irish television, such subjects were debated. I mean, he had a show in, I think, either the late 70s or early 80s on sort of gay rights, which was not heard of at all on RTE. Various vigorous debates on subjects like birth control. There's a famous clip of Gay demonstrating how to use a condom, for which he got a lot of criticism at the time, when I think such devices were banned in Ireland.
Yes, they were.
Divorce, abortion.
And Ronan, we'll just play a clip, and just to explain to our audience, this is radio, not television, but he's showing up a condom not only to the audience in studio, but to the entire population of Ireland. Because you've got to remember, there was only one channel on a Saturday night as it was broadcast then. Everyone watched the Late Late Show, and a lot of nasty letters came into the RTE studios after he did this, showing the condom. Let's take an audio grab of that now.
Okay, if you'll pardon the expression, Roisin, would you roll it there, please? The condom is made of rubber, whether you knew it or not. There are two main types.
I would not encourage my children to use condoms.
How old are your children?
One's 27, one's down at the 24, but you have to leave.
Never before has your show stooped so low to discuss so little. Oh boy, what a show it turned out to be. Not a holy show, but a dirty, disgraceful, rude, garbage heap of codswallop.
Of course, we recognise that people have misgivings about homosexuality because it's something that they don't come across every day.
How can you say it's normal?
Yeah, that is
my perfectly,
main
that's normal for me.
It's not normal for a man to be preoccupied with another man's back passage.
What about men who are besotted with women's front passages? Is there a good answer to that?
Okay.
Good evening.
Hello. You're asking what would we do if our husbands had an affair?
Aye.
A lot of us would be only delighted to get a rest.
Gee, Ronan,
how
did you get away with that?
Well, you know, if you remember, Henry, one of the very early, I mean, I can't even believe I'm describing it as a controversy, but it was at the time, was the Bishop and the Nighty affair, if you remember that. And this was an early Late Late Show in the early 60s, when Gay Byrne was asking newly married couples in the studio audience what they were wearing on their wedding night. And one newly married woman declared that she wasn't wearing anything at all. And this triggered a ferocious letter from a Catholic bishop saying it was purveying filth and how disgusting and shameful it was. And Gay Byrne offered an apology the following week, and he realised it was a mistake, Henry. Gay Byrne never, ever apologised after that for anything.
From Australia, this is Bondi Tune.
So if you've just joined us, this is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world and also from Sydney, Australia, where I am. And I'm talking with Dawn Drost, our North America political correspondent in Orlando, Florida. She is in Orlando, Florida. So that means it's time for Silly Floridian of the Week. Dawn, what's going on over there at the moment?
Well, this week we have a delightful man named Gumercindo Reyes Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He is 51 years old. This actually took place here in the Orlando area, so it's a local crime. He decided it would be fun to dress up as a woman and rob a bank.
Okay. I'm looking at a picture with this lovely gold dress.
Yes, he did not make a lovely woman. But he went into the bank anyway. It was a Chase Bank. Mm. He walked in with a sign, with a note that was written in Spanish.
Oh.
That said, I have... Yes, it was a multilingual crime. And it said, I have sufficient weapons to kill everybody here.
Did he have them?
Nobody knows. Give me your car keys. I want unmarked bills. And nothing electronic, because if so, I'll start to shoot. But he did have a purse, so no one really knows what was in his purse.
Little handgun. Little lady handgun.
Yes, it's possible.
Why do they hand the money over so easily? I thought they had all sorts of ways of avoiding this these days.
Well, they didn't give him much. They only gave him $1,000.
Mm.
And they could have, you know, the bank has a vault. You know, they could have given him a lot more. So they probably just emptied one drawer and gave him that. So as he was leaving, the deputy driving by noticed that Reyes was coming out of a restaurant called Pollo Tropical, where he had ditched his clothes and changed into men's clothes, and he was walking out of a bush. That is the first way you attract police attention. Use the sidewalk. Don't cut through the shrubbery.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came out of the bushes. He confronted the man. When he exited the car, he saw bizarre behavior. He attempted to subdue him by tasing him.
Uh-huh.
This is Florida.
Yes.
And that didn't work. So they ended up having a foot chase, and they ran across an extremely busy road, like eight lanes of traffic.
Shit.
This is one of the busiest roads. Actually, this is the busiest road in that county. Eight lanes of traffic.
Mm.
And into an apartment complex. There, the deputy reached for his gun and ordered Reyes to the ground. Reyes reached for the gun. Again, Florida. The deputy was able to regain control of the gun. I'm amazed that it did not deploy at some point and that nobody got shot. And the altercation continued. The deputy tased him again.
Cool. Was he not taseable?
I want to know. This man must have been on drugs. Because seriously, you get tased twice and you don't go down. You are on something.
Yeah, probably.
The tasing I have seen in person, that man was high as a kite. And they had to tase him three or four times.
My God.
But again, he was naked outside of a school. They tased him a lot, and he was just flopping like a fish on the sidewalk.
Was that another event, Dawn? Was that another thing that he did? He said naked outside of school?
Oh, that was one I saw in person. That was my introduction to Florida.
Oh, I see.
That was just driving to work one day. I was late to work. I just stopped and just sat in traffic watching that. I was just like, I do not know what's happening, but I am going to sit here and find out.
Did you ever want to turn your car around and go back?
Oh, I just stopped and watched.
Amusement.
I did. I just stopped and watched. Luckily, no one was around, so it was fine. Anyway. It was just me. Yeah. A witness named Corey Reed described it. He said, at this point, I didn't know what would happen. They were tussling on the floor. Thank you for that outstanding description. So deputy said Reyes then ran from the complex and got into the deputy's patrol vehicle.
Oh, my God.
So now we have tased twice, wrestled with the deputy, tried to take his weapon, and has stolen his car after robbing a bank dressed in drag.
You couldn't write this stuff.
Rachel Brunton is, of course, our entertainment reporter, and she lives in the ACT, the ACT, the Australian Capital Territory, and she joins me now from there. Rachel, how are you?
Yep.
Yeah. You see, if our North America correspondent, Thomas Booker, answered that, he would go, yep. And your yep was very close.
Very close. It's something that I've only started doing in the last couple of weeks. I'm just trying to, you know, not use up so much space in the world.
Isn't it interesting? Like, when you think about it, a lot of young people actually shorten everything. And you know, because you've got a daughter who does it on social media. It's like, you know, the millennials, they will try and sort of not actually say a whole word. They find a way of sort of
abbreviating,
shorting.
Or a brief.
From Leicester, the United Kingdom, Ling Pang on Bondi Tunes International.
Hi, this is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with legendary singer Engelbert Humperdinck, who has sold millions of records worldwide, courtesy of Livewire. Hello.
Hello, dear. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. Lovely to have you on the show.
You look very relaxed. Have you had a busy day?
I'm busy. You know, I'm as a matter of fact, you know, now that I've got this new album out, I've been doing a lot of interviews and radio shows, etc. You know,
I know,
because that's what we have to do. And thank God the social media, you know, it's easy to do in this respect.
Yeah, we all have to learn how to use it. I mean, the change is so fast. Without my son, I don't know where I'm going to be. it's so confusing, isn't it? And I understand that you just released a beautiful song. Your voice is so remarkable, beautiful tone.
Oh, thank you.
And in the 60s, you got two beautiful tracks. It's so memorable. Never forget, Release Me and The Last Waltz. When I hear it, I just feel so happy because you relax me when I listen to it. And, and it, you know, when I watch your video on YouTube, you only take 1 second to capture me. You know, I got, wow, he's right there. And you're still very active in the music business. Do you never take break?
No, I don't want to. I don't want to give up the business at all. You know, I never think about retiring. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking very seriously. Well, we are preparing to come to the UK next year for a tour.
Wonderful.
And I hope to encompass so many cities as well. And then, you know, we'll take it during the world tour next year. But this year, I'm also traveling quite a lot. I'm going to Chile in a couple of 3 weeks, you know, and to Philippines and Austria and all over the place.
Do you like Chinese food?
I certainly do. Of course I do.
Wow. Lovely. Well, I want to talk about your songs. In 1967, you released two incredible songs, Release Me. Can you tell me, your songs are romantic, but Release Me is different. How's that song come about?
Well, it's not a positive song because it says it's ask the person to release them and let them go. But in fact, I can't believe how successful it was, because it's on the karaoke machines all over the world, you know, and people love to sing that song, and yet it has please release me, let me go, I don't love you anymore. But you know, it's kind of the
did you get
thing.
To choose the songs back in the 60s, or you were asked to sing the song because they feel that you got a type of voice?
I'll be honest with you, I chose that particular song when I heard it. I heard it and I asked my manager, I said, let's record this one because I think it sounds like a hit song, you know. And it was recorded 5 times before, but I recorded it and it became a world hit, thank God.
It's beautiful. You know? And also the next song, The Last Waltz, because I love dancing. When I hear that, I just want to move my feet. It's so beautiful. Tell me, the 60s was the starting point of your career, or have you been singing before that?
Well, I was singing before that in little clubs and trying to gain experience, you know. So I was waiting for the big song to come along, and when it did, I was ready. And I think you have to have an apprenticeship in every trade in order to...
Would you consider yourself to be very fortunate to be in a business that you love and passionate with? Do you feel that you have achieved your goal?
I think so. I think with music I have, because it's been my passport to the world. And, you know, fortunately, my first song was went all over the world, so I had a global career immediately.
Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grabbed some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp.
Thomas, I know it's only 9 a.m. here in Sydney, Australia, but... do you have a beer?
Oh, Henry, I'm sorry. Hang on. Let's see if
oh,
I can...
Oh, Fantastic.
There we go. God, pop
There we go. We got a beer. Thanks, Thomas.
My pleasure, sir.
And myself and Thomas Booker got to talking about that genius, Arthur C. Clarke. Of course, Clarke did take over the writing of Space Odyssey, didn't he? I mean, he basically, they started working on, Stanley Kubrick and him were working on the script, as far as I understand it. But really, towards the end of it, it was really Clarke's baby, would you think?
Yeah, and Kubrick had no problems with Clarke going off and writing the novel. And there's a deviation in the fact that there's another little twist to the plot is that Clarke had the mission go after he basically explained everything that was happening in prehistory because he described all the stuff going on, described what the slab did and all that. But he wound up having the mission go to the planet Saturn rather than Jupiter. And so that's the novel had that little complication, and otherwise it was pretty much the same story. Kubrick decided that they didn't have the resources to do all the art and set design and models and all that to do Saturn, and so little was known about it. So he opted to go to Jupiter, which turned out to be something Arthur C. Clarke really grabbed onto, because shortly after the movie was released in the late 70s. And early 80s, the results were coming back from the Voyager missions. And the Voyager, all the information and data that Voyager sent back about Jupiter blew Clarke away, blew his mind. So he came out with writing the book 2010. Odyssey 2 is how he called it. And that basically, he incorporated all the science from Voyager at Jupiter into that novel.
Fantastic stuff. It's a pleasant novel, but
I'm infuriated by the motion picture, and that the motion picture they made of it explains why Kubrick chose to film it, film the original in England, because that's a lot.
Yeah. Now, before we move away from that, we want to just stick with the moon. Of course, he was obsessed with the moon and everything, you know, all the planets. Here's an audio grab of Arthur C. Clarke talking about the moon.
About 300,000 people involved in the Apollo program put men on the moon, and the total cost was about $20 billion way back in the 1960s, when $20 billion was real money. What is even more incredible is the fact that having gone to the moon, we left it for 20 years or more.
Now, interesting point, Thomas, is that he talks about not going back to the moon for 20 years after 1969. And he seems kind of surprised by that. You know, I'm thinking of conspiracy theories here, because there are people out there, believe it or not, who believe that man did not, actually go to the moon, that it was all, you know, rubbish. Anyway, what do you think? I am surprised. I'm not totally convinced that man went onto the moon, but... I'm just wondering, why did they not go back? And I'm wondering if Arthur C. Clarke was wondering that too, you know?
Well, I could go into a 3-hour rant here about the
Please
space
don't.
Program. But the reason to go to the moon had nothing to do with exploration and the expansion of man's knowledge or anything like that. It was basically to beat the Russians. It was an ideological, international struggle between the miracle of capitalism and the horror of communism. And so this was, it was sparked by the 1957 Sputnik spacecraft, and then later on Yuri Gagarin's flight, and later on...
Is that when they put a monkey up there?
It was a chimpanzee. The horrible thing the Russians did. Sputnik 2, they had a dog. It was a stray dog they found on the street, took in... petted it, you know, took care of it, trained it, and her name was Laika. And Laika was put on Sputnik 2 to go into orbit. And if you talk about cruelty to animals, then you need to think about this, because here's this dog. The dog was put inside a capsule.
Yes.
And it was just to sit there and see if it was alive. So it was isolated from people. It was put into a dark area. It was put on top of a rocket ship. It was launched into space. It was in space. It was dark. It was weightless. There was no telling what the dog was going through at that point. but was traumatized as hell. And then at the end of it, Sputnik re-entered. And the really horrible joke I have to say about it, I heard it a long time ago, Laika became the first Russian hot dog.
Oh, my God.
Burned up.
Oh, my God.
Burned up in orbit. I mean, just
it's
really
terrible.
Horrible,
stuff.
Yes. And then they had a second dog, I think, who they did send up. I forget her name, but I think somehow they tested the re-entry technology. I think she survived.
Okay. That's a very sad story for treatment of animals, no doubt about it.
Talking politics to real people, it's Bondi Tunes International.
Bob McKenzie is our Irish correspondent, and he joins me from south of Dublin, Bray, County Wicklow. I do believe, Bob, that it's 16 miles south of Dublin. Is that right?
Well, so they tell me.
wouldn't you know?
You know, it has been known that I have walked back from the centre of the city back out to Bray on drunken Saturday night. So, Jesus. You know, I'd say that's about right.
You must have been.
I thought it was a bit longer, but you know,
you must have been sober by the time you got home.
Well, I was. You know, many's the time I've been there in a garage, 5 miles out of Bray, having a nice Mars bar and a Coke. You know, yourself.
As you do, yeah.
Just to keep you going at 3 a.m. when the kebab's worn off a bit. You know, Paul McCartney was headlining Glastonbury on Saturday night.
Mm.
And, of course, Paul is now 80. And he was on anyway, and he was doing his thing. And then he said, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a special guest for you. And he brings on Dave Grohl. Now, I'm reading Dave Grohl's book at the moment, and I would recommend it to your listeners. It's a really good read. But, of course, Dave Grohl is a great man for hopping up on stage with other people and having the bit of fun. So anyway, I thought, this is good, Dave Grohl's on. So I watched Dave Grohl, and then all of a sudden he said, and then Paul McCartney said, and from the east coast of America, from New Jersey, it's Mr. Bruce Springsteen. And on walked Bruce Springsteen, and they did Glory Days. And then they did a track together. And then Bruce and Dave came on at the end for the encore. But what was hilarious was, Dave Grohl looked like your really stoned uncle. He was wearing a cardigan, granny glasses, and a t-shirt that just said ABBA. That is so Dave Grohl.
I love that.
But Bruce, of course, is looking very, very well because, of course, Bruce is going on what we think may well be the final tour next year. He's already announced the dates in Europe. I know that he's going to be announcing the dates in the UK fairly shortly. And I know that he's definitely going to be touring Australia as well, because, of course, Bruce loves you down there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, last time he was over, when he played Brisbane, he did that fantastic version of Staying Alive with a full classical orchestra, which was absolutely brilliant.
Oh,
so,
that sounds
you know,
great.
Bruce will be down to see you fairly shortly, my Antipodean friends. But I'm seeing him next year, 2 nights in Dublin, the night before my 58th birthday and the night after my 58th birthday. So I'm going to have a hell of a birthday next year, Henry.
Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grab some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp.
From Melbourne, Australia, Melissa Creamer on Bondi Tunes International.
And I talk with our Australian correspondent in Melbourne, Melissa Creamer, about, amongst other things, ghosting.
Oh, no, my friend got married and she was 54, first marriage for her.
Wow.
Bit of a love story there. So, as you know, I used to be a tour guide.
Yes.
And I probably know at least 30 plus ex-female tour leaders who have never been married or had kids. And I think it's because we're all kind of the strong, independent women type, and a lot of men don't know what to do with us.
Yeah,
so
they're afraid
I
of
could
you.
Rattle off, I think so, but I could rattle off about 30 of us over the age of 40, and we weren't always over the age of 40, but we've been single that long. And my friend Donna, she lived overseas and lived in Bali for about 10 years, and I worked with her in Thailand before that. And she'd met this guy when she was in high school on the CB radio, and they struck up a friendship over the CB. That was back in the days before Facebook, obviously.
Yes.
And this guy went off and got married and had kids, and she found his brother on Facebook years later and got in touch with Dave's then wife. And then Dave's wife unfortunately passed away from cancer. Dave and Donna reconnected, and the rest is history, and they got married. Ghosting is a new form of breaking up with someone where you just disappear. You don't tell them that you're not going to see them again or that you don't want to see them again. You just stop communicating with them altogether. So you don't answer their facts. Sorry, facts, gosh. The reason why I'm saying facts is because when I hear the term ghosting, it reminds me of a story that I heard about Phil Collins. And this was back in the early 90s or the mid-90s, about 94, 95. Fax machines had just become the whole rage. Mm. And apparently Phil Collins had broken up with his Wi-Fi fax.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, that's not exactly ghosting, because at least he let her know. That wasn't a good way of letting her know. But ghosting is when you just disappear, you know. And I often think of Casper the Friendly Ghost. There's nothing friendly about ghosting someone in the dating world, because, you know, I've had guys that I was seeing, and I'm talking guys that I've had sleepovers with, and, you know, they've hung out at my house, and we've been together for 6 weeks or something, and they just ghosted me. No explanation, no, Melissa, it's been fun. Sorry, I don't want to go through this. Well, I don't want to do this anymore. None of that. Just don't. They just stop responding to messages.
Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grabbed some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp. This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by our Australian political correspondent, Adam Devlin, in the beautiful, beautiful Melbourne. Well, it's almost as beautiful as Sydney. Adam? See what I did there? How are you going?
I did see what you did there, Henry. You let your insecurities show.
Oh, yeah, right. Melbournians don't have any insecurities whatsoever. They just want to be Sydney. Anyway, let's move on. Are you enjoying the Olympics?
Are they on? I've not watched a damn thing of it.
Neither have I.
So far, I've managed to avoid absolutely everything to do with the Olympics, which has been fabulous.
Yes,
it's
difficult.
In these times of COVID, you've got to look for silver linings where you can find them.
Indeed. It's almost impossible to avoid it. I mean, I'm not into sports either. And we were saying, well, fair, I'm not a nationalistic person. I don't care. I mean, okay, Australia's doing really well. Good for them. Interesting point. There's a Melbourne in Florida. Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
Hmm. And of course,
and there's I believe there's one in Canada as well.
There probably is. Of course, there's Dublin's all over the world, and there's Sydney's all over the world. Well, of course, we've got a correspondent, Dawn Drost, in Florida. Imagine if she lived in Melbourne. That would just be too confusing.
Talking music to real people. It's our music guru, Adam Devlin, on Bondi Tunes International.
You know, we grew up with radio that had singing jingles, and we still have them on Bondi Tunes International purposely. When you grew up in Eden, a little fishing town in rural New South Wales, did you have a local radio station?
There wasn't one in the town that I grew up in, but there was one in Bega, which was like an hour's north from us.
Mm.
And in fact, there were two radio stations. They had an ABC station and there was a commercial station.
Yes.
Yes,
I used to. Very good. You know, when I lived in Batemans Bay, which is just up road, well, by comparison to the size of Australia, I did listen to Bega Radio. I think it was called
2EB or something.
No, 2EC.
That's it, 2EC, and I loved it back in 96.
That's the station, that was the commercial station I listened to as I was growing up. Let's get on to this.
Yes, would you like to present this for us?
Absolutely. This, as I said, is the third single off Olivia Newton-John's album, Physical. It's an upbeat dance number. It tells the story of a politician who is in love with somebody else who may or may not be appropriate based on her career as a politician. It's sort of hints of the political sex dramas, and we've all experienced those in the media in the past. No matter where you are, you've had some politicians end up in trouble because of sex. And this song tides into that. So since we're midway through the election here in Australia, and all of the polls are indicating that the Labor Party here looks like they're going to win and potentially with a landslide, I thought today would be a good chance to play the song Landslide by Olivia Newton-John. So here she is.
Hold wind, it's really blow.
Welcome to Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years here on Bondi Tunes International. In this hour, I grabbed some of the funny bits from our interviews and some of the more serious stuff we've been keeping an eye on. Bondi Tunes International has correspondents around the world, and they are not short of words. So we're here in the Time Warp. And we welcome our listeners on FM in parts of Australia and New Zealand. I'm Henry in Sydney, as is Caitlin Erica, who joins me. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Now, I just want to explain to our listeners that you and I live in the same apartment block. And it must be 6 months ago when I was downstairs in our communal garden, just sitting down there, and you came down. We didn't know each other, and we got to talking for the best part of an hour about what you do, which fascinated me and still does. I wonder if you would mind just letting our listeners know what it is you do both online and in the physical world. I know it's okay, a huge question.
It is. How do I explain it? So I run events and programs for women around dance and sensuality. I help women to feel safe and sovereign and sexy in their bodies. I actually trained as a doula originally, but life has set me on an unexpected path, and this is where I've landed.
So let's talk about your online presence, and it is CaitlinErica.com. Tell me a little bit about how you function in this world, in the online world, and what you offer at CaitlinErica.com to people who might be interested in what you do.
Yeah, so I've got a few offerings. Online, I have actually my signature program is an 8-week program called Strip Her, and it's where I teach women to strip. It's mostly a metaphor. No woman is ever pressured into or expected to bare skin. I teach the art of striptease, but it's actually so much more than that. It's more about stripping away the conditioning, the stories, the fear and shame that we have around sensuality and owning the fullness of our expression. So that's my signature program, which started as an in-person offering, but which is now online as well, which I'm really excited about. That's the main one, really.
This is obviously a rhetorical question, but is stripping stereotyped?
Is it stereotypes? I mean, there's a lot of stigma around.
Stigma is probably a better word, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry, I was going to ask you, you strip yourself?
Yeah, well, I'm not anymore, but I was up until recently. Mm-hmm. So as I said before, I actually trained as a birth doula. And so that is an non-medical professional support person for the journey of pregnancy and childbirth. So it's kind of like a tour guide for the journey of pregnancy and birth, someone that will support a woman or a couple or family to understand their options, help them feel safe, be there as a physical and emotional support rather than a medical support. But after I did my training, I got a very strong intuitive message. Call it the voice of spirit, call it delusion, however it makes sense to you. But I got a very clear message to go become a stripper, because apparently the women there had access to something that I didn't, and they were to be my next teachers. So
what access to what?
Well, I had to enter that initiation to find out myself. I didn't know at the time, and I carried a lot of judgment and stigmatized strippers and sex workers. I was thinking, what on earth am I going to learn about birth from strippers? What am I going to learn in general from strippers? I'd considered myself pretty open-minded. You know, I'd been to Burning Man 4 times, even been to sex parties in a couple of different countries. Just, you know, I'm a seeker by nature. I'm curious. I want to see what is around in the world. But I still held some judgment for sex workers. And so I had this perception that, you know, maybe they weren't there by choice, they were a little bit lost, they didn't have other options. And so to then enter this time in my life where I was very much viewing everything through almost a shamanic lens and seeing everything as a lesson, as a teacher, every scenario, every person, every interaction, thinking, okay, what am I here to learn? What's why am I here? Why have I been sent here? And I really got to confront all of my shame and conditioning around sensuality and find my truths around freedom of expression and what's respectable, male, female relating, so much.
Our entertainment reporter, Rachel Brunson, is in Melbourne. Welcome, Rach.
Hello, how are you?
Well, as I said to you off air, I had a stomach situation going on, shall we say. I think a bit of food poisoning over
Easter. You're in digestive distress.
Very good. And you've just come back from Adelaide, which is your hometown.
Yes, I drove over all by myself, which is a bit of a feat because it's quite far.
Yes.
And, you know, I hate driving.
Yeah, you've always said that to me, and you've got a brand new car.
I do have a brand new car, and my brand new car and I have been all over the place lately. We drove from Canberra to Melbourne, then we went from Melbourne to Adelaide and Adelaide to Melbourne, and we got home last night.
Oh, my God, are you not tired?
A bit. I just think I'm just relieved to be home, and now I'm knowing it, because when I'm away, all I'm thinking about when I'm away is the fact that I have to get back.
So I just want to ask you about the Oscars. I mean, there are conspiracy theories going around saying that the Oscars, that this was all a setup, the whole slap. I wouldn't believe that, really. What do you think?
Well, Hollywood's basically cancelled Will Smith. All his Netflix movies have all been cancelled. That he was about to shoot. There was another movie that he was about to shoot that all the producers and the backers in the studio have walked out on. Yep. He had endorsements that have pulled out. He's basically been cancelled.
Cancelled culture at its best, right? Do you think that's fair?
And you know what? He should have. I think that he won't be cancelled forever.
Yeah.
He resigned from the Academy.
That's right.
Because you have to be a member of the Academy in order to vote. But that's a very sort of ceremonial thing to do because he can still win one.
Hmm.
He can still be nominated and he can still win another one. Not that he will. You have to be in something to be nominated and don't look like he's going to be working for a while. But he's also banned from attending for 10 years.
How does that work? Really
I don't know. They've just said that's what your punishment's going to be.
Let's say he did get another Oscar. How could they ban him from going there? It seems really odd to me.
Well, they can give it to him. You know, Will Smith was unable to be here because we hate him. So so-and-so will accept on his behalf.
Now, listen, with the Oscars, it is fair to say that they're kind of going down the toilet these days. Do you think it's kind of over for them or do they just have to change how they do things?
No, they just got to rejig it. I think they had a great idea with giving three ladies the chance to host together, Wanda Sykes, Amy Schumer, and oh my gosh, I can't remember the other lady's name, and I deeply apologise. But the thing that that whole business with the slap, what bothered me about it was that hosting the Oscars is a really difficult thing to do, and whoever hosts has to work really really hard. They write their material, they have to work very very hard. There's a lot of rehearsal, and it was obliterated by that one thing.
Yes.
And their effort was obliterated. But I think the Oscars had the right idea with getting three people to host and making them women of very diverse backgrounds because I can't be certain, but I'm fairly sure that one of them was I know Wanda Sykes is African-American.
Yep.
Amy Schumer is about as Jewish and white as
you can guess.
As they come, bless her. And there was one more lady, and I'm standing here, and I should know this, but I didn't research very well because I didn't know we were going to talk about this.
No.
There's one more, and I'm fairly certain that she might have been some sort of Asian American, but I don't know for certain. So they're pushing to go, you know, in a different direction. And they're trying to keep up with what's going on. Yeah, I think the Oscars has always got a place.
Yeah.
But I think it's becoming less of a big deal.
You've been listening to part one of Time Warp, a selection of snippets of interviews we've done over the many years on Bondi Tunes International. We'll have part two very soon. Thank you for joining.
Henry O'Donovan.